Welcome to Law Syrup, the show where we talk with special guests about hot topics in Canadian law. This podcast is a co-production with the Ontario Justice Education Network, also known as OGEN. I'm Herman Wong. Let's tap in. Before we begin, please note that this show is not intended to be legal advice or be a replacement for a legal representative. Welcome back to another episode of Law Syrup. Today's show includes a recording from OGEN's Summer Law Institute that took place in August 2024. Every year, this event brings together secondary school teachers from across Ontario for 2 days of panels, including experts from emerging areas of law and key legal issues. Today's episode features a discussion about the top cases from 2023 to 2024. Our presenter was Professor Sonia Lawrence from Osgoode Hall Law School. Professor Lawrence graduated from the University of Toronto and pursued graduate work at Yale Law School. Apart from her duties as a professor, she is also the current president of the Canadian Association of Law Teachers. So, without further ado, take a listen to her presentation.
Thanks so much. This presentation actually is one of the highlights of my year. I need to thank my excellent RA, Thea, who helped me put together the talk. And I need to thank all of you for being teachers and for the work that you do. This is something that I think of as very close to my heart. I remember my high school history and law classes, and I have one child remaining in high school. And I'm very, very grateful for all the work that you guys do and how difficult the difficult circumstances under which you do it. This talk, though, the brief was most top cases of the year. I'm going to say the idea of top cases is itself quite problematic, like thinking about what is the top case from the Supreme Court of Canada is a bit strange. And as a law professor, we are constantly getting in trouble from all the other social sciences for our fixation on Supreme Court cases. To do a talk on like the top five lower court cases would actually be really interesting. So I have offered a brand new bonus case that is not from the Supreme Court. So hopefully I'll have time to get to that. I think one thing that we should know about this year's Supreme Court cases is that there were very, very few of them. So 2023 was actually remarkable in the court's institutional biography because it was a year of historically low output. There were only 34 judgments in 2023. That's the lowest since 1947. And before that, it's the lowest since sometime in the 19th century. But it is a historically low number, and I think that's something to keep an eye on in future years. If you feel like I didn't hear that much about the Supreme Court last year, it might not be just because the reporters weren't writing about it or the news wasn't reporting on it. It might be because 34 cases is very, very low.
The first decision is a case titled McColeman.
So this is a case from criminal law. So I don't have a lot of criminal law cases. So I want to offer at least one. This is a case in which OPP officers saw Walter McColeman driving an ATV out of a convenience store parking lot and onto a highway near Thessalon on Lake Huron. So that's the convenience store. It's called Rob's Convenience. They decided to follow him. So he's on his ATV on a relatively major road in a relatively very rural area. So they follow him until he pulls into his parents' driveway. At that point, they approach him. They are making, at that point, a random sobriety stop. And they ask him to do a sobriety test. Then he tells them he's had about 10 beers, or he may have had about 10 beers. They take him down to the station where they administer a breathalyzer, and then he proceeds to throw up. And then they administer another one. It's very clear that his blood level is over the legal limit. Okay, so McColeman argues that the sobriety stop was illegal because it happened on private property. He was in his parents' driveway. The Ontario Superior Court and the Court of Appeal both agree with him, and they set aside his conviction. At the Supreme Court, he's not so lucky. He wins his charter claim, but he's still not lucky. How does that happen? The issue here is really, what's a driver? The police are allowed to stop for random sobriety checks, according to the Highway Traffic Act of Ontario, a driver. There are two definitions of driver that appear in the Highway Traffic Act. The first one kind of describes a driver is someone who is in care and control of the vehicle in a particular set of places. The second one just says a driver is someone who is in care and control of a vehicle. The particular set of places clearly excludes a private driveway. But as you may know, care and control could just mean you have the keys and you're in the driver's seat. Doesn't even mean the car has to be on. So this is the dilemma. Chief Justice Wagner and Justice Obomsawin write for the unanimous court. The police do not have the statutory authority under Section 48.1 of the Highway Traffic Act to conduct any random sobriety stops on private property. The conclusion here on the statutory interpretation issue is that he wasn't a driver at the time he pulled into his parents' driveway. Even if the car was still moving, he's not a driver, right? For the purpose of these random traffic stops, a person who has care and control of a motor vehicle but is no longer on a public highway, which includes all those other things, not just highways, would not be a driver under the Highway Traffic Act. So that means it was unlawful for the police to stop Mr. McColeman. It was unlawful for them to administer the sobriety test and the breathalyzer. And the stop was illegal under Section 9 of the Charter. However, this is why he wasn't lucky. As you may know, the Charter contains a provision which allows evidence obtained in breach of the Charter to be used anyway. That is Section 24.2. The test for determining whether they could use the blood alcohol level that they collected involves three things. So the first two, the seriousness of the Charter infringing conduct and the impact of the breach on the Charter protected interests of the accused, get balanced against the third one, which is society's interest in the adjudication of the case on the merits. In this particular case, they decide the unlawful police stop is a marked but not egregious violation. The impact on the Charter protected interest is clearly meaningful, right? Because they took the blood sample and breathalyzer sample from him. But talking about the seriousness of drunk driving as an offense and the high reliability of the evidence that was collected, so they decide they're going to allow the evidence in anyway. So that's one thing. And I think other thing is like the situation at the time, courts of Ontario had come to different conclusions about when a person was a driver. So there were actually courts that had said you could do these stops on private property. And the court says, well, that's true that there was an unsettled state of the law, but the duty on the police officers in that circumstance was to be cautious.
The next decision is called Hansman and Neufeld.
In 2016, the British Columbia Ministry of Education launched Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity 123, which was a new program with the goal of fostering inclusion and respect for students' gender identity or expression. That's Barry Neufeld. He is the elected public school board trustee. He publicly criticizes this initiative online, and it triggers a lot of controversy and calls for his resignation. Glenn Hansman is an out gay man, a teacher, and a former president of the BC Teachers Federation. He was contacted by a reporter, and he was asked for his comments on what Mr. Neufeld had been saying. He then publicly denounced Neufeld's views. Eventually, Neufeld says to Hansman, you have defamed me in particular by saying that I engaged in hate speech, and he launches a lawsuit. Hansman then applies to have Neufeld's defamation action dismissed as because he treats it as part of this strategic litigation against public participation, so slap suits. Have you guys heard of slap suits? Well, the original idea was that large moneyed corporations can often just bring lawsuits against activists and effectively scare and litigate them into stopping their commentary, right? So the acronym is SLAP for Strategic Litigation Against Public Participation. In British Columbia, there is an act, an anti-SLAP act, called Protection of Public Participation Act. What invoking this act on Hansman's part meant is that Neufeld would have had to illustrate that the harm he is likely to have suffered as a result of what Hansman said is serious enough that the public interest in continuing the proceeding outweighs the public interest in protecting Hansman's expression, right? So you're balancing the harm to the school trustee against the public's interest in hearing the expression of the teacher. So generally, the court says in this case, the closer that expression lies to the core values of freedom of expression. So what they say is Hansman's speech is considered counter speech. Counter speech that was employed to counteract harmful or ignorant expression. And they said it's clear that Hansman was motivated by a desire to combat expression he thought was harmful and discriminatory. And finally, they say Hansman's counter speech was proportionate to the speech that Neufeld was putting out in terms of his opposition to the new program. I think this case is interesting to talk to students about, possibly because of the context, but also because slap suits and anti-slap legislation are something that I think, if you don't already know about them, it's an interesting way to think about the way that law is used. When we think about our freedom of speech, we don't always recognize that our freedom of speech basically operates against the state. And things like defamation suits actually do have a significant impact.
The third case is the Reference Re-Impact Assessment Act.
Okay, so this is a federal legislation which calls for extensive environmental assessment before a project can go forward. And the issue here is that the federal act includes, as well as all kinds of things that clearly are in federal jurisdiction, it includes a thing called a designated project. And under this part of the rule, the federal government can designate certain projects under the Impact Assessment Act, and it can designate them where there are going to be effects within federal jurisdiction. So the question arising is that a legitimate exercise of federal jurisdiction? Is that a legitimate use of federal jurisdiction? As you may already know, jurisdiction over the environment is split. So one of the things that the court really struggles with, how do you deal with the relatively, not bright line, but relatively clear separation of jurisdiction between the federal government and the provinces, and the completely diffuse nature of environmental issues, right? So, or of environmental harms or environmental impacts. So that has produced a lot of litigation around federal legislation, which attempts to do environmental protection. This is the latest piece of it, but unlike the Greenhouse Gas Protection Act, the federal government, I think we would have to call this a loss for the federal government, because what the court says is that this designated project, part of the act, is unconstitutional. And the reason is because that term, effects within federal jurisdiction, does not align with actual federal legislative jurisdiction. So the overbreadth of that phrasing, effects within federal jurisdiction, exacerbates the constitutional frailties of the whole act. So they strike out the designated projects part of this act as the remedy. Okay, so the decision in this case is a real blow to environmental activism or environmental protection. The power to designate projects was a significant one, and it was one that people were relying on in a lot of contexts. So I think this one might be interesting for these reasons, for the provinces getting the federal government out of the way of these kinds of infrastructure projects was a huge win, I think. I'm not sure whether this will prove to be a win for Canadians. The jurisdictional fighting over the environment, as we have seen in other cases, occasionally seems to be totally counterproductive to preserving the environment and any quality of life issues for the population.
The fourth case is the Reference Re an Act Respecting First Nations, Inuit, and Métis Children, Youth, and Families.
So this one's also a reference. The weird thing about references is that they're not cases. And so technically, if you guys talk about stare decisis, references have no precedential value technically. Nobody treats them that way. Everybody treats them like they're binding precedents, but technically, they're not cases. I mean, that is the That is very lawyerly and nitpicky. People will, these cases are incredibly important. Many of the most important, I would say, most important Supreme Court cases have been references, and we all treat them as though they matter, right? But technically, they have no binding powers. Okay, so this act is a very unique, I think, effort on the part of the current government. What it does is it sets out national standards and principles establishing a normative framework for culturally appropriate child and family services. And those normative frames are things like best interests of the child and ensuring cultural continuity. And it does so in the context of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis child and family services. And then it affirms an inherent right of self-government on First Nations that includes the jurisdiction to make laws in relation to child and family services. It then goes on, and this is really interesting, to provide that laws made by Indigenous groups, communities, or people are going to be given the same force as federal legislation by this piece of legislation. What does that mean? What that means is that in the case of conflict between a provincial law and a federal law, you guys know that in the case of conflict, paramountcy, the win goes to the federal government, right? If there's conflict, the federal law prevails. What this federal law does is it brings all of those Indigenous laws or laws made by First Nation community into the federal space, which means that those laws would then be paramount over provincial legislation, right? So at this point, it becomes not that confusing why Quebec kind of got a little bit nervous about this and sent it for a reference. So the bigger issue here was really this decision to bring all of those laws into the federal space and thereby make them paramount in the event of conflict over any provincial laws. Okay, and the court says, that's fine. There's no problem with that. If the federal government is adopting or bringing in these laws, there's no problem with that. It doesn't, what they said is it doesn't alter the architecture of our constitution. So the whole act is valid under the federal government's power under 9124 of the Constitution Act 1867, which is Parliament's legislative jurisdiction over Indians and lands reserved for the Indians. And the Supreme Court said this act aims at protecting the well-being of Indigenous children, youth, and families by promoting the delivery of culturally appropriate child and family services, and in so doing, advancing the cause of reconciliation.
The fifth case is Dixon and Wuntagwichen First Nation.
So this is a case I feel like we've been waiting for a very long time. When I was in law school, we were talking about how eventually this case is going to come. So the facts here are Wuntagwichen had created residency requirements for anyone elected as a band official. If you were going to be a band official, you had to live in Old Crow. So Ms. Dixon was elected as a band official. And then she realized she needed to move to Whitehorse, which is a lot further to the south, because of her son's medical needs. But Wuntagwichen's bylaws said, you can't do that and retain your position on band council. She wanted to bring a charter suit on under Section 15, an equality claim against this rule that would have barred her from remaining a band councillor if she moved from Old Crow or if she moved from the settlement lands to Whitehorse. So the question is, are these laws subject to the charter? Is this bylaw passed by this Indigenous government subject to the charter? And also, obviously, if so, why? So this is the question that we've been waiting to come to the Supreme Court for a very long time. Because one argument, as you know, the idea of the Constitution is that all of the power has to be described within the Constitution. So every ounce of government power in the state of Canada is somehow described in the Constitution of Canada. So that would suggest that, in fact, whatever power is being exercised by Wuntagwichen's council, that is subject to the charter. But the other possibility, as we saw in the case just previous, is that it's an inherent jurisdiction. It's a jurisdiction that predates the Canadian state. It's a jurisdiction that predates even the thought of the Canadian state. It's the jurisdiction that those communities hold by virtue of, in the language of the court, by virtue of having lived on that land since time immemorial in organized societies with their own governments, customs, and laws. So Vuntut Gwichin obviously is arguing we're not subject to the charter in terms of the laws that we make on our lands about our people. And now the court has to decide this. So the majority is Justice Kassir and Jamal, and they say the charter does apply, and it does apply because Vuntut Gwichin's government is a government. Okay, so the charter does apply. They then say, but because Ms. Dixon's claim prevent Vuntut Gwichin from creating a law that says you have to live on the settlement lands, because of that, they say there is another right at play here. That other right is the right to make all kinds of rules that serve as cultural protection and community preservation and are community-based rules. So requiring that the VGPN leaders live on the settlement lands helps to preserve the leaders' connection to the land, which is deeply rooted in the community's distinctive culture and their governance practices. And it also bolsters the community's ability to resist outside forces which continuously pull people off the settlement lands. So charter does apply, but in the end, it doesn't matter. So I think these two last two cases, both the Act about Child and Family Services and this Vuntut Gwichin, illustrate two sides of the struggle that Indigenous nations are having now for recognition of their inherent powers of self-government. And I think that's one way you can think about this. The Vuntut case, I think, is quite complex because the Supreme Court's decision that First Nation governments are subject to the charter, even if in this case the charter was not being given effect, is a blow to some understandings of what exactly Indigenous sovereignty is, and the fact that it predates the charter and is not actually subject to the charter in many arguments. So the question of how exactly the charter is binding these governments, which are neither provincial nor federal and predate the charter, is a big question. But on the other hand, there's quite a long history of Indigenous women activists who have sometimes articulated concerns about gender discrimination within Indigenous governance and complicated wish for something to prevent that from happening. So you can see that two of the justices, Obomsawin and Martin, both said that the charter would apply and they would have agreed with Ms. Dixon's claim and they would have invalidated Vuntut Gwichin's bylaw. And then you also can see Justice Roe, somewhat surprising to a lot of people. If you're avid court watchers, you may find this somewhat surprising that Justice Roe came out saying, actually, the charter shouldn't apply to Indigenous governments at all. And this is a backdoor route to making these governments subject to the charter when they had no say in the negotiations, they had no participation there, and this is an inappropriate thing to do. So this is a really interesting place also, if you're really into this, to think about what's that about? Is this just a point of principle that he really believes this and he's going here? Or might there be some other longer term thing that he's thinking about that I haven't been able to figure out what it might be yet?
The bonus cases are the court's response to Saskatchewan's use of the notwithstanding clause in the charter.
So the bonus case is like really obvious. It is the set of cases from Saskatchewan, and it's about Saskatchewan's invocation of the notwithstanding clause. So this is where in August 2023, the Saskatchewan government releases this policy about pronouns in schools and basically says if you're under 16, if you're 16 or under, the school will not be able to change your name or your pronoun without talking to your parents. essentially. So this policy seems to come out of nowhere. It comes out in August, and then immediately there is a challenge. Let me just be more clear about what that is. So parental guardian consent will be required for the school to actually start calling the student by another name or start using a different pronoun. And where there is a reasonable expectation that seeking consent could result in physical, mental, or emotional harm, the school will support the student towards speaking to their parent. In other words, they still won't be allowed to change their name or pronoun at school, but the school is bound to provide that some kind of support. So you may recall the media coverage of this, that this was one of the things that people really wanted to talk about was, why are they doing this? Where was the impetus for this? There didn't seem to have been a large discussion or kind of public debate in Saskatchewan before this. So some of the discussion was about that. But immediately, UR Pride, which is the University of Regina Pride organization, got together with a couple of other groups and asked for an injunction to basically suspend this while they went forward with a lawsuit against this policy. So on the 28th of September last year, there was issued by Justice McGaugh a interlocutory injunction on the basis of potential irreparable harm to the claimants, in this case, the claimants being affected students. The government of Scott Moe told us that they were going to not withstand that legislation. So meaning that they were going to invoke the Charter Section 33 so that they would not be required to comply with any charter ruling that might come down that would tell them that they weren't allowed to have this particular policy. So what they do is they enact the legislation, and inside the legislation, which is the way that you use Section 33, they put in the language that is required to say, notwithstanding the provisions of the charter, et cetera, this legislation will, et cetera, right? So the thing then has to go back to court, and on February 16th, the injunction is lifted because the judge has to say, well, now I have very little that I can do about this because now they have invoked Section 33. The charter no longer is going to govern this situation. The first judge does say, like, I can still do the work of determining whether and how this policy or this piece of legislation does infringe rights, but I can no longer provide any kind of relief from that situation. This obviously got massive national news attention. And I think that there are two ways to think about this or to talk to students about this. One is just the context of this particular case and exactly what was happening in this particular case. So the facts of this case, the situation of the Mo government, maybe the seeming total unconcern of the Mo government that their electoral chances would be harmed by invoking Section 33. And also some interesting discussions about the language of parental rights. But the other way to talk about this is this may be a sign that we are entering a new era of charter litigation, which is that if Section 33 is going to be increasingly invoked by our provincial governments, and there's lots of signs that that's ticking up, then we find ourselves as litigators, court watchers, students, and educators in a very different place than we've been before. Because it's rare for litigators to contemplate, should we bring this suit? Will we provoke this government into invoking Section 33? And what will our next move be if that happens? So we didn't used to think that, but I think it's fair to say now in certain areas, in certain provinces, that has to be part of legal strategy. What will we do if this is the decision they make? Most of the invocations of Section 33 have not been tested in the only place that they will be tested, it seems, which is the ballot box. So the next provincial election, does anybody care that Section 33 was invoked? Does the electorate feel like that's something that needs punishment at the ballot box? Or are these people making wise strategic political decisions about the size of their base and the things they can get away with? It's really unclear, but this is so different from what we've seen since 1982. I think everywhere except for Quebec, Quebec is definitely an exception here. And surprise, like Alberta is not the province that has kind of led the way on the new use of Section 33. But I think this might be, for students who want to talk about rights, this is an incredibly important discussion because of the way that both in popular culture and in legal culture, we tend to treat rights as a kind of a trump card, and they are not. The other thing is, you know, there's some hope that we're going to see a more robust approach to Section 33 by the courts. I personally don't think that's going to happen, but some of the effort is going towards how can we get the courts to be more aggressive when governments invoke Section 33, like they did in this case and in the Quebec case, when they invoke it in situations where it is a relatively disenfranchised minority that is bearing the brunt of the invocation. For those of you who now feel like really we need to find a way to cement court decisions to kind of lock those down so that they are what govern and we need to get rid of Section 33, you can flash your mind for 30 seconds to the situation in the US, which might lead you to the exact opposite conclusions. So perhaps in this case, you might say, what was the government's justification for doing this? Had they done broad consultations with the population of Saskatchewan and discovered that this was an enormously important issue? And you may remember that what they had is like a couple of letters. They had very, very little on the inside. But you might say, did they consult experts about whether there was anything else they could have done? And the answer again in this particular case is no, they didn't do really anything. There's no indication that they did anything like that.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Law Syrup. Law Syrup is produced by me, Herman Wong, and the Ontario Justice Education Network. For more information, check out ojen.ca and our show notes. See you next time.